Morgan Housel, who is the author of The Psychology of Money, wrote an article called When Everyone's a Genius. And I'll link to it in the show notes, but it's his take on speculation and essentially optimism, which is what ultimately drives a bull market. Do people believe things are going to get better? If they do, the price of the stocks keep going up. There's a couple of gems that he dropped in the article. I'll just make a couple of quotes. The first one is that every investor is making bets on the future. It's only called speculation when you disagree with someone else's bet. Welcome to the Rich and Regular podcast presented by Success, where we explore life at the intersection of money. I'm Kirsten.
And I'm Julian. Today we're talking about bull markets. Bull markets.
Ironically, bull markets are a good thing because typically whenever bull is in front of something, somebody's about to be insulted.
It took everything in me not to say it. It is one of my favorite words, actually.
Bull markets.
Bull markets.
Nobody says it that way.
I know.
So this is actually going to be a good episode. We are not insulting you. Unclench those fists, listeners, and buckle up for a ride about markets.
Yeah. So bull markets, you know, it wasn't until we started to think about this episode that I realized how interesting that word is, not just because it is like the beginnings of one of my favorite cuss words, but it was actually a really great reminder of how jargon, specifically financial jargon, makes financial conversations feel exclusive.
Yes.
There's an entire language there that most people don't fully understand. And so naturally, when you don't understand the jargon, you don't engage in that conversation.
Yes.
It's like it's another language. When people are around you and they're using language and lingo that you just don't get, you sort of like, I don't know. You look left, you look right, and you just sort of do the Homer Simpson and you back away. Yeah. So it's really, really interesting.
Yeah, I feel the same way about all the acronyms. Like, I don't know why we're continuing to invent acronyms for new financial products, because I feel like even if you win somebody over, you talk about investing in stocks and you get them excited, as soon as you throw out an acronym, a Roth IRA or a 401k or a HSA, it's like, no.
Yeah.
I understood. And then you start throwing out them letters. And now I'm like, I don't know what to do anymore.
It's very similar to the gears that turn when you are an amateur in speaking another language. It's like in your head, you can visualize going back to the workbook and the dictionary, and you just can't keep up because you're not fluent in it. And so this is part of the reason why I think so many people get bored or just don't engage with these conversations. But you know what's interesting? This also made me think of, as we were exploring bull markets, it made me think about a very early money memory, and I cannot believe I did not remember or think of this earlier. And so when I was a kid, one of the few VHS tapes that I had, I mean, I can literally almost, like, my memory is bringing me back there. I remember owning Airplane. I remember having Naked Gun. And I remember having Trading Places. And Trading Places was one of my absolute favorite movies. Obviously, we're talking about the 80s. Eddie Murphy was a huge star. At the time, he's still a pretty huge star, but he was, like, really, really, like, one of the biggest names in Hollywood. And Trading Places was one of my absolute favorite movies. And I just realized that that was actually what I used to think a bull market was. So there was this scene in the movie where there are several scenes, but this is one particular scene where they are at the New York Stock Exchange, or at a stock exchange. I don't know which one it was. And you could see all of this frenzy going on, and people are on the trading floor, and there's just all this like crazy activity happening.
This is it, the last bastion of pure capitalism left on Earth. Here in New York, they trade everything. Gold, silver, platinum, heating oil, propane, cocoa and sugar, and of course, frozen concentrated orange juice. Now, the people on the phones are taking orders from brokerage houses all over the world. The runners then hand those orders to the traders in the pits.
Yeah, so just listening to that, it really like brought me back to my childhood. There was like Dan Aykroyd, who was huge on SNL with Eddie Murphy at the time. But like that was one of my absolute favorite movies. But you would see all of this craziness on the trading floor and people holding up their like papers and like selling commodities, and Mortimer and the other guys were talking about like pork bellies and frozen orange juice. I had absolutely no idea what any of this stuff meant. But my young mind just thought that, like, because it was so wild and crazy, the only other visual that I had in my mind at the time of that was, like, the running of the bulls in Spain. And so in my mind, I have no idea why, but, like, yeah, I just always thought that that's what a bull market was, which to me, like, that should probably be the actual visual for it, because that's about how crazy it looked and feels, I would imagine, on the trading floor.
Yeah, I actually, you've reminded me that I also have an adjacent money memory here. My dad, who is almost as country as they come.
Almost.
He used to say things, he used to say this phrase, pigs get slaughtered, anytime he thought we were being greedy. So if we would ask for another cookie, he would just be like, pigs get slaughtered. And I thought it was just some backcountry shorthand. But later in life, he actually used the full sentiment, which is actually bears make money, bulls make money, pigs get slaughtered.
That's right.
In other words, you can make money in any of these markets unless you get greedy.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I have early, you know, bull market memories too. I'm sure other people do. They just have never made the connection.
I love that. And I'm telling you, like, that is one of the biggest projects that I want to undertake at some point is
How we talk about money.
How people talk about money and jotting down all of these sayings that are rolled into religion or social norms or cultural norms, because those are, without question, the very first memories that most people have. This is how we learn about money. And it's really a carrying forward of the beliefs that your parents or guardians or mentors generation held, right?
Yes.
They believe this thing. It gets boiled down to some sort of catchy statement. And through oral tradition, they get sort of get fed to the minds of children, and people carry those beliefs forward.
Yes.
In this case,
even when they're not working anymore.
Correct. In this case, it was absolutely wrong.
Yeah.
Right? Like, that is not how a bull market is defined. That's bullshit, right? I've been trying. I pulled the trigger so quick on that. I was, like, really trying to find a time and a place to drop that. I don't think that one worked. So I apologize. Anyway. That is not what a bull market is defined. Why don't you help us and our listeners understand exactly what a bull market is?
So, according to Investopedia, a bull market is a market that is on the rise and is economically sound, while a bear market is one that is receding and where most stocks are declining in value.
Yeah.
So, again, bull markets are good. Things are going up. Bear markets are like things are going down.
Yeah, and I am becoming very much a visual learner here. So there's part of the reason why there's a bull outside of the New York Stock Exchange, right? They are proud of the bull. There is no bear out there.
Right? No.
That is bad luck. You don't like that, right? So a bull market is the good times. That is sort of the embodiment of it. So if you ever see that sort of visual, there are financial firms that have sort of extended that into their visual branding and logos and that sort of thing. Like, everyone is all about the bull markets because those are the good times for investors. Off the top of my head, I'm trying to think. So the 80s, I remember, I'm really aging myself right now, but like the 80s, so that was a really, really big boom or a bull market. The dot-com era, I remember that. Definitely the early 2000s, like those moments like after, and the moments after the Great Recession in 2007, 2008, those are all sort of known as really, really big bull markets. When the market is doing well, investors are very happy. Companies are sort of churning out profits. New companies or industries are sort of being created, and investors are really, really happy as week after week, almost, it feels like there's a new high.
Mm-hmm.
The Dow Jones, S&P, everyone is up.
Yeah.
Obviously, I wasn't investing back in the 80s or the 90s. I wish
when you
I
were six.
You know what? I wish I was. If I knew, I would have picked up a couple of things. Those were definitely a few of the early memories of bull markets that I can think of. Do you have any, like, memories, like visual memories of a bull market?
I'll be honest and say not really. Like, I can remember dips and spikes on key days. Like, I remember the news after 9/11. I remember, you know, when the NBA shut down and the markets tanked after COVID. But, like, cinema, film has really provided me with my view of a bull market, if you can even call it that, of what it might look like to people who are most impacted.
Yeah.
And it's exactly what you described. It's people shouting on trading floors, just a bunch of hoopla and papers flying and a bunch of calls and angry people shouting. And then I also, it's funny you brought up the Wall Street Bull. I also have that statue in my head. So it's, again, just like a bunch of like iconic symbolism, yep. Which means I've been socialized under capitalism correctly. A great American experiment is working because I have all of these like vast symbols of like prosperity in my head when I think about bull markets. I'm not thinking about the everyday climb of like percent by percent by percent,
yep.
Until the point where they are like, oh my God, it's been doing that for a while. Yep. We're in a bull market.
And I think that makes sense for most people, whether you want to admit it or not. Most people aren't actually sort of locked into CNBC, reading the Wall Street Journal depth, right? So most of us are sort of consuming a derivative or sort of symbolic translation of what any of these things mean, which means a lot of things sort of get lost in translation. So that is why we are talking about it today. There's a lot to think about, though, when we are talking about things like a bull market. So let's get started. I think the first thing is to recognize that bull markets are typically followed by and preceded by bear markets. There is a natural cycle here. And so if bull markets are the good times, there's typically sandwiched between the bad times, and then the cycle sort of repeats itself. Mm-hmm. Now, naturally, this brings you to a classic old saying, which is buy low, sell high, which naturally brings you to another critical question. Well, when?
Right.
Like, when do you do that? When do you know if this is a low point or the lowest point? Meaning, when do you make the decision to invest while, like, you know, trying to avoid losing money, or that money is sort of continuing to dip as a market sort of falls? The other way, or the other side of that coin is conversely is, when do you sell? When do you know that the high point that you are seeing is the highest point, that something is going to continue to go up? The reality is you don't know, right?
Yeah.
The answer to the question of when is you don't know. And really, like we've said before, the beginning to just about any financial question is always going to be it depends. And so we spoke about time horizons in a previous podcast episode. Naturally, it's going to come up again in this one. So the first thing to think about here is, what is the time frame that you are investing in? And in general, if your objective is to buy and sell in under a year, then you're what's considered a short-term investor. Think options traders or just like everyday active daily traders. Most people are not that and not interested in that. They're typically buy and hold investors, meaning you are buying stocks and mutual funds and you're holding them for more than a year. You're what's considered a long-term investor. That's who we are for the most part. And I think most typical people and families are like that as well. So this means you actually don't need to worry nearly as much about when you're buying. And so this whole idea of bull markets and bears, whether or not you should be investing today, tomorrow, because the market may go up or down, is really not that relevant for you. It's actually more important for you to focus on buying and or contributing steadily to your accounts and your funds than it is for you to make an educated guess about when would be the right or the ideal time to buy.
Yeah, I've always thought that buy low, sell high is just far too broad. Like, it's like that kind of throwaway advice, like sleep when the baby sleeps. And it's like, okay, well, yeah. Am I going to do laundry when the baby does laundry? Am I going to cook my meals when the baby cooks meals? Like, it's just, it doesn't make any sense because it's so subjective.
Yeah.
And then to your point about like being a short-term or long-term investor, I feel like I'm having a bit of an identity crisis with a lot of people because I find myself being both. I find myself being both a short-term investor and a long-term investor, depending on the week and the financial need. I am investing for my future, and I'm investing so that I can use capital gains to take advantage of opportunities that come up in the next, you know, 2 to 3 years, or just to keep up with the rate, the inflation rate,
yep.
Because like a normal savings account isn't going to do that. So it's really, like you said, it's not something that you can just try to guess. The goal is to just be present, kind of assess your needs and the opportunities in the market to best kind of fulfill those needs.
Yeah. And I think a lot of people can probably hear that. And it's like one of two feelings. One, it's like a sense of relief. Great. Like, I don't have to learn how to master or time the market. I think for another group of people that's probably like, oh God, that just adds to the anxiety.
I know.
Because I don't know whether or not, like, it's like, listen, you are, and we've said this before.
The anxiety is
you
real.
You will lose money in the stock market if you are a buy and hold investor. It's okay. That's not really what you should be paying attention to. There's so many other things. And it's a catch-22 because we want people to be actively involved with their retirement. But I don't necessarily want you obsessing over right. how the market is moving and what impact that's having on your investments, particularly your long-term investments, because that's not really what you should be paying attention to. Mm-hmm. Like, you don't know or you won't really see what the true impact of just holding and in many cases doing absolutely nothing will look like until you get there.
Right.
Right. And that could be 10 years from now, 20 years from now. So you really need to find other indicators or sort of focus on the things that you can actually pay attention to that'll actually help you to ease the anxiety. So one of the ways that you can do that, there is a phrase for it, and it's called dollar cost averaging. There's another name for it that that is escaping me. But for the most part, most people refer to it as dollar cost averaging. This is a financial technique that I think will help a lot of those people who are concerned or experiencing some of that anxiety. And so it is defined as, I believe this was from Investopedia, an investment strategy in which an investor divides up the total amount to be invested across periodic purchases of a target asset in an effort to reduce the impact of volatility on the overall purchase. The purchases occur regardless of the asset's price and at regular intervals.
Wow.
It's
quite
a mouthful.
The nerdy.
it is.
A lot of gobbledygook.
It is, but it goes back to what I was saying. Like, you hear that, you just nod your head and you say, got it. And then you move on. Here's what that means. Here's an example. If your goal is to invest $6,000 this year, just focus on investing the same amount of money every single month, right? Which is $500, or break that down to a week. I don't know how much that is in a week, but let's stick with just a month, right? Focus on investing $500 a month. Doesn't matter whether or not the market is up. It doesn't matter whether or not there are people on the news and you're seeing visuals of people saying buy, 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 mm-hmm. or sell, sell, sell. Ignore that. Just focus on investing $500 a month so that you can get to your goal of having invested $6,000 a year. I'm a foodie, so I will give you another way of thinking about this. Let's say you are making soup because it's fall weather, and I think most people want nothing more than a nice, warm, delicious bowl of soup. You don't just throw in all the seasoning. Now, some people do, but you don't just throw in all the seasoning in the beginning, right? You sort of should be seasoning as you go, tasting as you go, so that when you're done, you've got this amazing, delicious, well-balanced, just perfect bowl of soup that you can enjoy. And it's the same thing with investing. If you season it all at once in the beginning, you could over-season it. If you don't season it at all, you could under-season it. Mm-hmm. And then some of the flavors sort of feel a little off. So think about seasoning a little bit as you go. That also helps to give you a much more sense of control over what's happening. And then when it's all said and done, you should be happy.
Yeah, I love that metaphor. One, because, you know, one of the reasons I didn't cook before was this fear of like a failed meal. Like,
exactly.
You talk about the anxiety of losing money in the stock market. My anxiety around cooking was like, what if I don't like it?
Now you're, right. You're wasting money.
Yeah, or wasting money, wasting
time. You
gotta
punish yourself by eating
exactly
yucky.
But you taught me that, like, I can reduce the anxiety and the surprise of a failed meal by tasting as I go. Mm-hmm. And so instead of cooking to try to mirror a recipe perfectly, it kind of lowered the stakes to just cook as if I needed to eat it when it was done. And so I could add in flavors or just adjust proportions as I needed, which usually meant adding some kind of cheese or dipping sauce just to make it feel like I'm going to be able to eat this when I'm done regardless.
Right.
And I think, you know, dollar cost averaging is one of those strategies that does the same thing. It's actually the strategy that I'm using for crypto. It just helps to mitigate the psychological stress of the volatility. And so if you just buy a little bit of crypto every few weeks, since regardless of the price, right, you just buy it, it makes you stress less when a coin loses like 30% of its value day over day.
Yeah.
And to be clear, like, I know I talk about crypto a lot almost every other episode. But the vast majority of our investments, 95%, maybe even 99%, go into traditional assets like the stock market.
Yeah, and that's important. And you know, I'm drifting here, but I'm thinking specifically of the young man that we met in Cleveland. I don't know if you remember conversation.
Yeah.
We did a talk for a company in Cleveland. We got off the stage, and typically after you do that, a couple of people come up, they ask questions, and this guy came up, and he was super excited. He was saying how much he loved what we were talking about, and then he immediately jumped into crypto, which we did not talk about crypto at all, but he was like super excited about it, and he said that he had $100,000 worth of Bitcoin a couple months ago.
$200,000.
Okay. Yeah. Wow.
It wasn't just Bitcoin. It was a number of coins. But he had 200. He had started with like a $10,000 investment.
Yep.
It had quadrupled to 40,000. He made some changes, and that 40,000 then quadrupled to 200,000. So he went all in on one of these alternative coins, altcoins as they're called. And,
and he was like, got it up to 200,000. My question for you is like, how do you know when to sell, when to take the profit?
Yes, because he lost it all.
Gone.
He lost it. I think he still has the original 10,000. Like, he didn't lose it all.
He was down around 40 or 50, I think.
Yeah, he was devastated.
Yeah.
And although he had never like held that money, he had it and could have cashed out at any point. But he, you know, pigs get slaughtered. I don't want to call the man greedy. If you're listening, I'm not saying you were greedy, but I am saying you probably should have took out some of those gains.
He was overconfident.
Yeah.
Optimistic. And bullish, dare I say, on his crypto wallet. Anyway, that's kind of what that made me think of. And really, the advice that we gave him was like, you know what? It's great that you are up. You know, at the end of the day, you're still, to your point, up, right? You're not up nearly as much as you were because you put in 10,000. You were sitting at around 40 or 50. But what we did tell him was like, next time you get up like that, cash out, take that profit, put it in something that's much more stable. So that you don't have to go through this again, because I'm telling you, I don't know that you're going to make it if you get back up to 200 and you lose it
again.
That's
a life-changing amount of money.
Absolutely.
$200,000.
Absolutely.
Like, wow.
Yeah. Okay, let's get back on track here. So we've spoken a little bit about bull markets and how to hedge against the conundrum of knowing when to invest. I think a lot of people struggle with that. But there's another layer to this, which kind of goes back to the example that we were just talking about, which is the psychological impact. And this sort of leads me to another old saying in the personal finance world, which is something to the effect of everyone's a genius in a bull market. And what they mean, or what that saying means, is that during these good or great investment periods, there are significantly fewer cases where people actually lose money. If you're a novice investor, a first-time investor, you're doing well. That sets the tone for your experience in investing. And naturally, you sort of give yourself far more credit than you probably deserve in terms of being a savvy investor or having picked the right funds or listened to the right person, et cetera, even though there's likely more going on here. So in a bull market, when a market is booming, there's a pretty good chance that you're going to make money. The unfortunate aspect of this is that it leads to inflated perceptions of one's abilities. Now, people tend to believe that they are financially savvier than they are, they're smarter than they are, when everyone is winning. But unfortunately, as we spoke about some of the natural cycles, is that when we start to transition into a bear market, you don't know when that's happening, but that confidence sort of still carries through. And unfortunately, it has a tendency for people to make bigger bets, end up feeling or end up being over leveraged on something and taking bigger risks, which unfortunately can lead to some pretty disastrous results, as in the example that we just mentioned. So it reminds me of, like, it's probably not a perfect example, but it reminds me of college athletes who are stars on the team, or even high school athletes. Like, you're a big man, you know, on the block, big man on campus, or a woman in
big
this
fish,
case.
Little pond.
Exactly. And then you get to the next level and you are not prepared.
Right.
You're not the fastest. You're not the strongest. You just, and you get crushed.
Yes.
Yeah.
It actually reminds me of an article, naturally, bookworm, nerdy. Morgan Housel, who is the author of The Psychology of Money, wrote an article called When Everyone's a Genius. And I'll link to it in the show notes, but it's his take on speculation and essentially optimism, which is what ultimately drives a bull market. Do people believe things are going to get better? If they do, the price of the stocks keep going up. There's a couple of gems that he dropped in the article. I'll just make a couple of quotes. The first one is that every investor is making bets on the future. It's only called speculation when you disagree with someone else's bet. So it goes back to the subjective nature of the idea of investing to begin with. And then the second quote is, optimism always overshoots because it has to. The correct price of any asset is what someone else is willing to pay for it, because all asset prices rely on subjective assumptions about the future. And like a blind man who doesn't know where a wall is until he bumps into it, markets cannot know exactly how much people are willing to pay until they go a little too far and say, ah, in hindsight, that was the limit. And that's when things start to, you know, decrease and go into a bear market. And then this last quote was the one that really stuck with me. This one says, investing is not the study of finance. It's the study of how people behave with money. I think that's so key. Like, we say this all the time. If it were just down to the nuts and bolts of good financial addition and subtraction, then 95% of these companies that are like blue chip stocks would not be valued where they are, because a lot of them are drowning in debt. A lot of, if you add up their inventory, like, it's nowhere near what we consider the value of the company.
Some of them aren't even profitable.
Right. A lot of them aren't even profitable.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a bit of a mind bleep, you know what I mean?
Yeah, it is.
For a lot of people. But I think what this also makes me think of, and this could just be sort of the moment that I'm in as I'm thinking about so many of the investing in personal finance personalities that are out there. We are, quite honestly, a part of that group of people. There's a tendency to continue to sort of center yourself as the expert.
Right.
You know what I mean? And I think this is part of the reason why so many people don't necessarily want to promote these types of ideas, which I believe is the fundamental truth, because what it does is it sort of makes the true power of investing live outside of any one person or any one sort of personality or company, etc. Like, we are here to tell you, like, while we are pretty savvy, right, and we have a pretty strong track record, we don't know it all.
Right.
We are still very much learning, and that's a part of it. But that's also our goal for a lot of our listeners, our readers, viewers of our content, is that ultimately we want you to just be more engaged with your money, to pay more attention to your money, to focus on both short-term, long-term, all of it.
Yeah, to learn by doing.
To learn by doing, and to slowly start to rid yourself of giving other people more control or power over your money, because that is not the ideal place to be. Not to say that you shouldn't outsource some things.
Right.
Right? Like, we would never go so far to say that. But ultimately, this is about sort of getting everyone onto a journey and treating it no different than you would your hygiene. Even the busiest people don't outsource brushing their teeth in the morning. You know what I mean? That's something that you admit and claim full responsibility of. And so think of it more so as a bit of financial hygiene. I also want to shame myself for having still not read this book. I've actually quoted it. I've recommended it. I was looking forward to it.
I mean, you've been writing a book, in fairness to you.
You're right.
You haven't done a lot of reading, because we're trying to come up
that.
With our own
that
version.
That is actually why I didn't read it.
Yeah.
Is because I cannot.
It'll have you questioning, like, it's like, dang, why didn't I get my sentence that
and concise? I'm very absorbent too, right? So I don't want to include other people's.
Like a sponge.
Thank you for reminding me, because I'm in such a weird place right now. Like, we're done with the book. We're like in between sort of final edits and publishing. Anyway, let's go ahead and wrap up this conversation. So there is another area of bull markets that we want to cover, which is, well, how long do they typically last? I actually did not know this. I would have guessed completely incorrectly, but at the risk of this sort of adding to the tendency for people to want to time the market, I still thought that this was a pretty interesting area of this conversation that was worthy of mentioning. And so I found a statistic from a market research firm called Invest tech. And basically what they're saying was the average bull market duration since 1932, which, by the way, was the end of the Great Depression. Most sort of statistics tend to start from that time because that was such a tumultuous time that it sort of distorts all of the data. So in most cases, you're always going to see ever since 1932, 1933. Mm-hmm. But anyway, the average bull market duration that they are, or that they calculated was around 3.8. I'm going to go ahead and round up.
Years?
So, years, yeah. 3.8 years. So let's just go ahead and round up to four. But even still, like I did not know that, but even still, the longest one in history was one that literally just ended, right?
Yeah.
So if you talk about the end of the Great Recession, which was 2008, and so then we entered into a bull market, which was 2009, mm-hmm. and then we rode that baby out past 4 years, past 8 years, and then we got basically to 2020, which it took the pandemic to end it. And then even still, I remember while this was happening, I remember thinking, wow, this was long overdue because I had this sort of benchmark in my head, which is around 10 to 11 years. For when a recession is sort of due. I remember that ending, but then, like most people, I will say this, most people thought, like, oh, we're going to be down in the dumps for a while. Like, mm-hmm. no one in their right mind would have predicted that the market would rebound as quickly as it would during the pandemic. And even now, like, we're sort of, I don't even know where we are. It's like a bear, right? So we might need like another quarter or two to figure out exactly where we are because we are truly coming out of a remarkable time right now.
Yeah, the news is weird. It's like yesterday's high was last week's low, or yesterday's low was last week's high. Like it's so confusing because it's incredibly volatile. So you don't know what the benchmark is. You have to wait till things stabilize.
Yeah, yeah, it is. We are definitely in wild times. So why do I bring this up? Well, I don't bring it up, like I said, to incite you to try to time the market. I'm not suggesting that since the last longest bull market ended last year that we should sort of be anticipating a bear market. The reality is nobody really knows. I think it's fair to assume that that may happen, but we don't know for sure. We can speculate, which is what the mainstream media and financial media does, but we don't know for sure. It's wise and common for people to use historical returns and performance as an indicator, right? Or a predictor of what's to come, but we don't really know with pinpoint accuracy. And so going back to our recommendation, what the strategy should be for the vast majority of people is what we recommended earlier, which is to focus on the amount of money you want to invest and to do that steadily, regardless of how the market is performing or what you anticipate may be coming. In other words, focus on what you can actually control.
Yes. All right. That's a great way to end. I don't even want to layer anything on that, add any dip to it. We can move right on to final thoughts, and I'll even let you go first since you're feeling poetic and profound.
I'm feeling bullish. That I think that is my final thought. It's, you know, like, listen, bull markets are wonderful. They feel good. For those that are invested, if you're not, then it's safe to say that you either feel like you missed out or you're just ignoring it completely. But savvy investors know that most real wealth is actually made during those downtimes. So that's not to suggest that we should be fearful of bear markets. You should look like, especially as an investor, you should feel like those are actually great opportunities for you to start investing. You are essentially purchasing stocks or real estate or whatever it is at a moment in time where they are likely undervalued and likely to increase. And focus on what you can focus on. Focus on building those steady habits and the discipline to ignore the hype, to ignore the good times and the bad times. Don't give yourself too much credit, but just focus on creating that discipline. Focus on generating the income so that you have the funds available to invest steadily regardless of where we are.
Yes. So happy you mentioned habits because I was going there too with my final thought. My final thought is if you make investing a habit through dollar cost averaging, paying yourself first, and like the myriad of other financial advice and tactics, you're less concerned about trying to label a market, which, by the way, can only be done in hindsight.
Love that.
So by the time they call it a bull, a lot of the gains have already been made because it's been increasing steadily along the way until the point where somebody decides to call it a pattern and label it a bull market. So just keep investing. Stay the course. Just keep making it a habit and you're able to catch these things as they come.
I love it. I love it. Well, thank you for listening to another episode of the Rich and Regular Podcast presented by Success. If you like what you heard, stop bullishing. Leave us a 5-star rating and review. We would very much appreciate it.
Yes, go bullish on those reviews. We will see y'all next week.